looking back fifth grade at Washington Elementary School in Waupun, Wisconsin, I remember a lot from my teacher, who is Mr. Painter. Mr. Painter was 22. He had just graduated from the University of Wisconsin and was new with us. He had this youthful spirit, and he thought 10-year-olds were God's gift to the earth. In September for science, we were asked to bring in a can of Coke and a nail. We each poured our Coke into a cup and then deposited the nail in the fuzzy soda and took notes that week as my favorite beverage progressively ate away at the nail. Mr. Painter said, "Think about what that's doing to your stomach." I didn't want to think about that. In English, we wrote about our heroes. I picked Gelsey Kirkland because she was most often paired with New York City Ballet with Mikhail Baryshnikov. But as I got to about the third chapter, like all of her yuckiness kind of slided out of the book, her eating disorders and drug addictions and family problems. So I did what any good fifth grader would do. I dropped Kirkland like a flea jumping from dog to dog, and I found a different dancer, Cynthia Gregory, to write about. Apparently in fifth grade, I wasn't able to hold shadow and light together as one holistic version of humanity. It is a good thing for all of us, me included, definitely, that my emotional intelligence has risen. In social studies, we did American history, states, the capitals, Thanksgiving. We read some original source material and things from our textbook and watched boring overheads. This time we were asked to write a letter to one of the Puritans or Indians we were learning about. We started with our questions. Did you really wear buckskin all year round? Did you get seasick across the ocean? Did that big ruffle thing that looks like a starched paper fan around your neck get in your way with your chores? After the questions were articulated, we were asked to answer our own questions from the viewpoint of the Puritan or Indian after having studied them for a month. I want to share with you one of the examples of the original source material that we did read. We had about a couple paragraphs from it, but it is the sermon that John Winthrop, who later became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he did this sermon to his fellow brethren. And here's just a short excerpt. "We must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection. We must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberty. We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, and rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our commission and community as members of the same body. We must consider that we shall be a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us, so that if we shall deal falsely with our God in this work that we have undertaken, and so cause him to withdraw his present help from us, we shall be made a story and a byword through the world." Had Winthrop been at a different event, I don't know, say like Woodstock, and he was a boomer and he was doing the emceeing, you know, those words of interconnection and benevolence, justice, and mercy, they would have fit right in. Of course, it would have been oh so much more groovy, and it would have not had the thou shalt not piece to it and a punitive God, but you get the picture, right? His words are seemingly expansive, not isolating. In the end, the memory I have from fifth grade is this joyous big picnic of togetherness, of pilgrims in black hats inviting the Indians to dinner to share their food with them, very magnanimous indeed. In fact, that story has become the centerpiece of what a lot of scholars in this country call the American civic religious liturgy. The story we tell our children. It's a story we all know, the myth we root the founding of our country on, and in the end, it's a big lie. The Thanksgiving story is what my grandfather used to call a bunch of bunk. In fact, John Stewart, the comedian, gets closer to the truth when he says, I celebrated Thanksgiving in the old-fashioned way. I invited a number of people to my house, and we shared a meal. And then I killed them and took their land. John Stewart, he's a smart man. Truth is, as adults, we all know darn well the common story told isn't the real story. We know that by the time the Puritans made it to the Americas in 1630, the native populations were already decimated by disease and illness, mostly smallpox and influenza that came over with trappers and traders who were European. So as the Puritans put their buckled black shoes on the rugged shores of Cape Cod, 90% of the Native Americans in that part of the country were dead. In other words, they didn't have much pushback to their arrival, and there certainly wasn't a welcome party. As one of Roger and my colleagues put it, these Puritans who escaped religious persecution became that of persecuting others. They burned witches at the stake, they slaughtered Native Americans, they enslaved Native Americans and Africans, and they made this country theirs through the sword and the gun. And when you put the story that way, man, is that harsh. It's harsh, right? It is not a bedtime round up the children, hey, sweet dreams, teddy bear, neat and tidy story. It's scary, which may be a good thing. As it is often said, the truth will set you free. Yet it only sets us free if we are willing to let it. When we perpetuate the same story as if innocent children, we fail our past and we, more importantly, our present and future. Perhaps James Lowen says it best. He wrote this fabulous book, and if you haven't read it, read it. It's called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Here's what he said. Feeling good is a human need, but it imposes a burden that we cannot bear without becoming simple-minded. Trying to claim our innocence after knowing the facts makes us simple-minded and, well, plain unethical and immoral. History continually unfolds here and now, and armed with the truth, we can engage the past to create a future that indeed will serve as that vision of a golden city on a hill that Winthrop was calling for and proposing. So today, I hope you indulge me a little bit. I'd like to go back in history and ask Governor Winthrop some grown-up questions and elicit a conversation with him. Here's the letter I would really like to write to Governor Winthrop. Here it is. Dear Governor Winthrop, today marks the 16th day of the 11th month in the year of our Lord, 2014. I have been anxious to write you for many years because there is a lot to be said. Last week, I read this anthropologist's work, his name is Sol Tax, who claimed that what you kicked off with relationship to the Native Americans in this country should be considered our country's original sin. I know that's big, huh? You didn't see that coming. But then again, you didn't live long enough to see the tumbling reaction to your decimation of the Pequot. You remember, actually, that you set out a whole little army because two Puritans had died. And that army went to a Pequot village and they murdered 700 women, men, and children. As the writer Sarah Vowell articulates in her book, The Wordy Shipmates, she says, for the English, for Winthrop, the Pequot War was a success ratified by God. It became the blueprint for all future wars on the continent conducted by the colonists and subsequent United States. The mass murder of the Pequot made the mass murder of other tribes possible and therefore repeatable. Was the first of many similar horrors to come. The Bear River Massacre, the Sand Creek Massacre, and the Wounded Knee Massacre, just to name a few. So here's the thing. You started us on this trajectory, and well, it haunts us now as a nation. Your Puritan vision of being God's chosen people as a beacon of righteousness that all others are to admire, it hasn't served us well. The most obvious and influential example of your mindset shows up on the first Massachusetts Bay Colonial official seal that you brought with you from England. And on it is an image of a Native American in a loincloth with a bow in one hand and an arrow in the other. And out of his mouth comes the words, "Come over and help us." Now, come on, Governor, that was never true, and you know it. The native people of this land never, ever crossed their heart and hoped to die, ever invited you over here, ever. In your defense, it's what the British did. I get that. My favorite British comedian, Eddie Izzard, does this little sketch of the British obsession with building empires, and I can see that you have seen it. As we built up empires, we stole whole countries. That's what we did, build up empires. We stole countries with the cunning use of flags. We just sailed around the world and then stick a flag in. I claim India for Britain. You can't claim us. There's 500 million of us. Yes, but do you have a flag? We don't need a flag. It's our country. No flag, no country. You can't have one. That's the rules I just made up that I am backing up with this gun from the National Rifle Association. Thank goodness we can laugh about that. In truth, what you did was put us on a track for U.S. exceptionalism. And this mindset has gotten us into more skirmishes, battles, wars, and just plain bullying of our allies and our enemies than I care to count. Currently in the U.S., we often forget we can love our country without thinking it is above every other country out there. We don't always do this, but we certainly have a proclivity to do it. Yes, this place rocks. I love this country. And I see how you came to love this country. And yet, in some ways, I think you had something in your view of God that kept you in check, at least in your mind, and your Puritan brothers and sisters as well. You may have grandiosely thought of yourself as God's chosen people, but you also believed you could fail your God as well. What saddens me, I think, is that we have inherited this idea of God's chosen people, the U.S. exceptionalism part. But we don't hold the humility aspect close enough to our hearts. And when we lose that sense of responsibility and worry of disappointing our God, we lose the ability to see the error of our ways at times. Our heads get too big. So your understanding of yourself and the world regarding the aspect is worth adopting. I can be a patriot and yet want us as a nation to not disappoint our God. We can remind each other that by living into the universal religious charity towards others, humility will follow. Not one above another, but together as a human family. Whether we believe in God with a big G or God with a little g or God within or the God of one's deepest moral conscience, we all hold the knowledge that we don't want to disappoint that God. And the only way to get to the good of all is to worry we are not living up to the highest of our ideals and standards in service to the love of our country and each other. Thanks for the lesson, Governor. On to the second thing I want to bring up. In this day and age, there's a lot of talk about illegal immigrants. People all over this country are worried there isn't going to be enough to go around. We are worried that these illegal immigrants will take our jobs and our resources and our standing. But you know what I just realized this last week? You guys were the first illegal immigrants. That's right, the Puritans, the first American illegal immigrants. Because as I said, there was no native tribes asking you to come over and help them. And you can put it on a seal of the Massachusetts colony peace all you want. It still doesn't make it true. In truth, you folks were not invited, nor did you have permission to come. You showed up and did your little flag thingy, and that was it. But on Thanksgiving, we celebrate your arrival to the new land. And it seems worthy of lifting up that really nobody here, except those already living here to begin with, isn't an immigrant. Some were taken by force and some freely came. But now in this country, we are starting to get lost in who belongs and who doesn't belong. Where do we put up a wall? And where do we not put up a wall? Today I'm reminded that there are very powerful stories within the Bible, Governor, that you know very well, but I just want to remind you of when it comes to welcoming in the stranger. It's a story of Abraham, the father of faith for Christians, Muslims, and Jews. In biblical accounts, it's really difficult to discern what Abraham actually believed. He doesn't possess a certainty of faith. He is regularly confused and talks often with asking many questions. But this patriarch of the great Western traditions did indeed possess one marvelous religious experience. You gotta imagine him sitting outside his tent on a hot day. Sweat drips him from his temples, and the tribe is resting, trying to stir not from that baking slowness of the day. And he barely moves, and his wrist clicks back and forth with the big fan, and I'm sure he had a cold glass of Chardonnay at his side. I would. He looks out at the horizon, and there are three strangers. Now, in the ancient world, you know, Governor, that was more violent than now, and that strangers always represented a threat. And yet, what does Abraham do? Pulls himself up off that blistering ground. He brushes the sand from his robes, and he walks toward them, and he says to them, "Hola, ¿qué pasa?" Not really. He inquires, though, as to their well-being. Instead of being on guard, anticipating a potential threat, he sets out the best of what he can offer. He spreads extravagant dining clothes, prepares and serves the guests an elaborate meal, plentiful meal. He offers comfort and solace. They converse and swap stories, and it happens quite slyly, without fanfare or oracle, that one of these strangers is Abraham's God. So it is that Abraham's act of practical compassion leads to an encounter with the divine. It was in Abraham's lived experience, in the choice to transcend focus of his own needs, that the divine was ushered in. Yep, that's the story that we should tell on Thanksgiving. When we all sit down to dinner, it is a reminder that the divine is ushered in when we make room, when we offer a seat at the table, when we live from that place of abundance instead of scarcity. When we see one human, not stranger or illegal, but human, one and all. Abraham's story is a Thanksgiving story. Finally, I'm going to commend you, and I know you got to hold on to your seat because I haven't given you too many accolades so far, but this one is all yours. In your sermon a model of Christian charity. You use the language of we all the time, not I, but we. You say we must uphold a familiar commerce together in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberty. You say we must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own. You say we must consider that it shall be a city upon a hill. That is amazing. You set the stage for the unfolding of this country's highest ideals. And I mean that. You made it everyone's mutual obligation to hold to the dream of what we could be together as people. You made the responsibility of the common good fall to each of us. And you may not know this, but the documents that followed you, well, they used we too. E pluribus unum, which has been on the seal of the United States for a couple hundred years, meant out of many states or colonies emerge a single nation. Most recently, it has been thought of and suggest that out of many people and races, religions, and ancestors, there has emerged a single people and nation. The pledge of allegiance that we profess to our flag has this wonderful word in it, one country under God, indivisible. And in that word is the sun and the moon and the stars, the glue of the pledge. The glue that binds us to the rest of our fellow travelers. Indivisible is not just talking about the flag, it's talking about the republic. Republic from the Latin res publica, which in the vernacular means a public thing. Republic, a reference to the collective to which is held publicly to the people. Our documents hold the essence of your we language, which makes them inclusive, empowering, and sacred. Yes, we don't often get it right. We still struggle with xenophobia and homophobia and racism and sexism and religious intolerance, the other, but the basic roots, which show up in the pledge, in the Constitution, in our language about ourselves includes we and our mutual obligation to each other. I'm getting down to this. On Thanksgiving, we celebrate a meal with others. We look at back at what we did, and the facts are blurry, really, and as are the logistics, but at one point you did sit down and have a meal with the natives of this land. You sat shoulder to shoulder, perhaps uncomfortably, perhaps rigidly, but you shared a meal together nonetheless, and you broke bread together as we, whether you recognize that or not. And I've come to realize that this Thanksgiving celebration for me is deeply patriotic. It is indeed what the historians call an American civic religious liturgy. It is living into the we. It is saying, we the people can and do break bread together. It is in the abundance that we share that we can offer it to others. And 11 days from now, in my family, I am going to be asked to say the grace over the meal, a benediction of sorts, to what we gather for. And I am going to use this poem by Alice Walker called The Patriot. If you want to show your love for America, love Americans. Smile when you see one flower like his turban, rose pink. Rejoice at the eagle feather in a grandfather's braid. If a sister's bus rider's hair is especially nappy, a miracle in itself, praise it. How can there be homeless in a land so crammed with houses? Love your country by loving Americans. Love Americans. Salute the soul and body of who we spectacularly and sometimes pitifully are. Love us. We are the flag. I know, Mr. Governor, this likely isn't the picture of the city on the hill that you imagine, but it is the evolved modern version of the flag that you would now have to stake your claim in. Indivisible are we. Love us. We are the flag. Gratitude for your lessons for Thanksgiving, Reverend Corn.